Hi, I'm Dawn. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you so much for asking me to speak. And it's great to see some friendly faces and to meet some new folks as well. I'm from Richmond, so it's not that far. It takes about an hour and a half to get here, not that far at all. And I love the reading that you guys just did. There was a speaker that I heard last night, and he read that before he spoke, and it just really kind of reminds me of why I'm up here. So I will kind of get right to it. I started drinking when I was 2, which is kind of, I know, not many people can say that, but I don't, it's kind of how my story goes. I don't remember it. Obviously I was 2, but my mom tells me that, she had a screwdriver and I, sitting on the table and I drank it and I drank the whole thing and I was underneath the coffee table with a pen in my ear, writing in my ear. I guess I liked it from the beginning, from the get-go. Before I'd even started the kindergarten, my uncle would have cake parties at my grandparents' house. I lived with my grandparents too, and so did my mother, but I would love to go to these cake parties at 4, and I would sit right by the keg, and I would pour the kegs for everybody, and they would tip me a quarter, and apparently I love that too. So, that's kind of when I came in here, and I didn't understand why, when people were describing how they drank, and I was like, well, yeah, that's normal. I mean, obviously that was like a very normal life for me, because that's, I started off from a young age, and I was around it, and it was just that was just kind of part of it. So, I don't have the story of saying, when I first drank, I had some like crazy, spiritual experience. I mean, I don't remember when I was, really young when I first started drinking. I do come from a family of alcoholics and addicts. So, I kind of remember when I was younger thinking that alcohol was good and drugs were really bad. And I do remember kind of like getting beers from my dad or my grandfather, and when they had those the canned beers, and when you would like click them, the phone would all pop up, like come up to the top. And I would when I was little, off the top of it, and then give them the rest because you don't want to spill everywhere. So when my mom was my father, who I call my father, he was a heroin addict. So my mom divorced him, and she raised me and my brother by herself, which is, I didn't realize this when I was younger. That's really hard to do. I was watching TV the other day, and one of the characters on the TV show was saying how her mom had her at a really young age and how hard it must have been for her mother to do that, she would never want to have a daughter that young of age because she would never want her daughter to feel like she did that, to her mother. And, I never thought like that. I never thought like that. I never thought what my mom having me at a young age did to her. I am way too selfish and self-centered. I thought, oh my gosh, what is wrong with you? Why would you do that to me to have me at such a young age and make my life like this? Like, I never thought like that. So, I kind of had a lot of resentment going on, and had a lot of reason to what I thought was blame my mom for what was going on with me. My mom would work; she worked really hard. She would work 48 hours on and 48 hours off. So to me that was fantastic because on those 48 hours off, I could do whatever I wanted. And I got a job. I grew up in a beach town, not that far from here. And there was a lot of college kids. And so basically your choices for work were like restaurants or construction. And, a lot of people got jobs really young. And I was 13, and I got a job working in a restaurant. And we would have, when my mom was off for those 48 hours, I would have parties at my house. I remember that summer going to a party, and remember the police coming, and I kind of remember hiding out in the closet so I didn't get in trouble, and I don't really remember the rest of the night. So you know, I started, I mean, blackouts for me are just kind of how I, part of my story. I'd always kind of blacked out. When, you know, but I don't remember it being, like, that really big of a deal. You know, I remember, like, being cool and, like, going to the parties and feeling like I was a part of and all that. But I don't really remember, like, drinking being that big of a deal. You know, I would kind of, I remember, you know, my mom would have liquor bottles in the house, and I would just kind of take a little off the top and put a little water in a Tupperware container, and then whatever, I don't know, you know, Coke or whatever we had, we would, me and my friends would, pull our liquor together, and then whatever drinks we had, like sodas, we'd put all that in too, and it was like really disgusting. But it did the trick, you know. And I could always, you know, get, I don't ever remember having a problem getting people to buy me alcohol or anything like that. So, you know, I would always, when I was 15, I was able to go into this bar that I really loved. I still, you know, this bar actually closed down, and they actually have yearly reunions, where everybody comes for this, they get together about it. And, you know, I really loved this place, and I would go in there, and, you know, the people that worked there would stick a beer in the bathroom for me to chug, and I would, you know, chug it because I couldn't drink out and with everybody else because people knew I was underage. So, but I was still, you know, able to drink, and it was a lot of fun, and it was a good time, and I thought I was, like, really amazing because I was 15 and going to bars, and I could get my friends in from high school, and I really just thought that I was the bomb. My senior superlative was most likely to own a bar, and that's probably why, because of that. You know, I, you know, did things, like, in school, like, you know, when it was time to take the SATs, I stayed out all night, and there was a guy that I really liked that was coming in town. He was in a band, and I thought he was really hot, and so I stayed up all night with him and drank, and then when it was, I had to drive out of town to go take my SATs with my friends, and I literally, like, not slept at all. I don't know if I was still drunk or not, but that was kind of, you know, when, I never retook the SATs, but you know, I kind of use it as an excuse too. Like, well, if I don't do well on them, then it's because I was up all night drinking. You know, that's why I didn't. So I didn't have to take any responsibility. You know, and then, you know, there wasn't. There were consequences when I was, you know, that age too. I would that first job that I had. We would steal beer and go in the bathroom and drink them. And I got caught having beer in my bag one time, and one of the managers of that restaurant pulled me aside, and, you know, well, she was bawling. She was crying so hard, and she was like, oh, my gosh, you know, you're 13 years old, and you're already stealing beer and drinking at work. Like, you know, what's going to become of you? Like, that's awful. And I did not think anything of it. I did feel really bad for her that she was crying so bad, and all I really remember was hoping that she wouldn't call my parents or tell the owners of the bar, I mean, of the restaurant. And she didn't, but, you know, I'll never forget her face, you know, of, and I need to make an amends to her. I haven't been able to get in touch with her, but, so, you know, there was people kind of telling me, like, hey, this is a problem from that age, and I didn't really, it didn't faze me at all, you know. When I was 15, we got, it was a school night, and we were at a friend's house drinking, and I had to take a six-pack for when I got home, because I just always liked to make sure I had enough beer, you know, even if I didn't drink it, I wanted to make sure that when I got home, I still had some if I needed it. So I, you know, took a six-pack home with us, went home with me, and we got pulled over by the police, and they saw this six-pack, and we all, I was only 15, so I didn't really get in as much trouble as everybody else in the car, but they all got in a lot of trouble because of me, and I got taken to my mom's work, because she was at work that night, and, you know, totally embarrassed her, like, you know, her kid's getting dropped off by the police, and she's working, I'm sure that was fantastic, you know, and I went off to college, and you know, it was amazing for me because it was like I had, you know, when my mom worked those two nights, had those two nights off, I could do what I wanted. But then when I went to college, it was like that all the time. So it wasn't like I had to, you know, make up stories about staying at a friend's house or anything like that. I could just do whatever I wanted, and you know, just, you don't have to do the math or anything. I'm 46. I don't care if you know. But you know, when I went to college, I could go out with $2, and that would be enough for me to do the trick. So I could get, there was like dollar pictures, and there was 10 cent. You could get 10 cents for a shot or a highball. And so, you know, $2 was like plenty of good to do the trick. So I didn't do very well in school because, you know, my goal was to go out and drink and get as drunk as I could. And, you know, I didn't have a whole, I mean, my mom got remarried at this time, and, you know, my stepfather sold his truck. You know, he had a brand new truck, and he sold that truck so I could go to school. And, you know, I didn't think about that, you know. I didn't, you know, that didn't faze me at all that my parents were making this huge sacrifice for me to be able to go to school, and here I am just, like, going and partying every night, you know. And my mom thought it would be a good idea for me to take 8 o'clock classes because that would help me to be responsible. And I was like, so of course, you know, the fact that I didn't go to my classes at 8 o'clock was my mom's fault because she made me get the 8 o'clock classes, you know. And if my mom ever went to college, she would have known that you're a freshman and no freshman should take an 8 o'clock class because all freshmen go out and drink every night and they can't make it to the 8 o'clock class. And that's really what I thought, you know. Because I thought the way that I drank was totally normal, and I thought that everybody did that, you know. And sometimes I remember I would kind of like go to, you know, be on campus, and I would kind of like look around at all these people, and there's a lot of people that went to the college I went to, and I'd be like, you know, I don't see all these people at the bars, you know, like, where do they go and do their drinking, you know, like, what do they do? Because there's a lot of them, and I don't see them all, like, and I don't know them all, so, like, you know, but the fact is they probably weren't living the life that I was living. But, you know, my perception is very skewed. I can't really tell the true from the false. So to me, you know, I really thought that I was very normal and that all college freshmen did what I did. When I got my grades back and I had not done so well, and there were some F's on that, my mom was not very happy, and she's like, "That's it, you're cut off. Like, I'm not paying for you to do this. You're like, you're done." And in my mind, I was like, "Sweet, I can just move to Richmond now, and do what I want and go to school there because that's where I wanted to go to school to begin with." So, sorry, you know. And but I mean, it didn't faze me at all. So I moved to Richmond, and, you know, I mean, at this point, like, my life was amazing. I was having a great time. I was on top of the world. I moved in with some friends that I'd met at the beach, and, you know, it was great. I loved it. I got a job, working in restaurants so I could work in the restaurant and then, go to the parties afterwards. And, you know, I kept meaning to get that application into VCU, but I just could never quite do it. And slowly I would kind of take a class here and there, and, you know, I would either have like an A, a W, or an F. And so I, you know, got a job in these restaurants, and then I started getting jobs in the bars in the Richmond area, and they were perfect for the way that I drank. Because not only did they let me drink at work, but they encouraged it. I could drink for free, and I could give away lots of drinks to my friends. So, you know, I mean, it was great. I had like a $200 tab that I could give away every single night to people. And that was at half off. So that's like $400 a night that I can give away to, like, so I would, like, you know, give out like 20 shots of tequila, like Patron, some really nice tequila, and And then, you know, the next round we would have, you know, like 13 shots. And then the next round somebody else would get them. And so, you know, that was the life that I lived. And, you know, I remember kind of at that point being like, man, this is getting a little crazy. You know, I kind of like chill out on drinking every night. Like I was, I'd always been a party girl. Like I, you know, I was the girl that you could call me and I'd already be in bed and they're like, hey, Dawn, let's go out. And I'm like, sweet, I'll be right there. You know, I'd like throw on a dress, stick my hair back, like, you know, maybe brush my teeth and out I'd go. Like I was always ready to go. You know, me and my friends, if we didn't have money, we would drive to Virginia Beach. And I really loved that because I was out of town. That meant nobody knew me. That meant I could drink as much as I wanted. I could make an idiot of myself. And it didn't matter because I wasn't going to see you tomorrow anyway. I would write. It was before the time of cell phones or Facebook, thank God. So I would write the phone number of the house where we were staying at on my hand because I didn't carry a purse, didn't carry any of that. The only thing I did carry is I had a fake ID for a really long time, and I never lost that. I would lose everything else, but I did not lose that fake ID. I even when I turned 21, I would lose my ID, but I still didn't lose that fake one. I had it for a really long time. And so we would go to Virginia Beach, and I would, you know, go home with some random guy, and you know, I mean, it was great. Like, I didn't even really know what they looked like in the morning. I didn't care. It's like, whatever. And, you know, I mean, I loved to drink. I loved guys. And I had a lot of fun. And my car, so the car I had at this point was, it was a Toyota Tercel, and it was off-white. And the windows had rusted out, so they didn't roll up. So, and you couldn't roll them up because they were rusted. I tried to get it fixed. And so my windows were down all the time. And I lived in the Fan in Richmond. So homeless people would like to sleep in my car. And it smelled like it. And there was, like, this much trash in the bottom with, like, beer cans and, like, all kinds of stuff, you know. So we would just throw out all the trash. We would take blankets and wrap them around ourselves and in the heater. So all the heat would go into the blanket and we would drive to Virginia Beach like that, even in the winter. Like, that's crazy. Because when we got there, we could drink for free and do what we wanted. So, you know, I mean, it was, and when I was in Richmond, I pretty much did the same thing, but it was just more fun going out of town because I didn't have to worry about those, you know, that humiliation and apologizing or making an idiot of myself or, you know, like any of those embarrassing things that we do. I didn't have to worry about any of that because I woke up and, you know, nobody was there to tell me about it. And, you know, at this point, like, I would still kind of, like, every night I would black out. I didn't remember. But I would still kind of wake up and know, like, oh, I should really avoid, like, that girl that I work with. You know, if I see her, I better duck and hide. Or I better, like, bring her a coffee to work or something or be, like, super nice to her because I know I did something that she's not happy with me. I don't know what it is, but it's something. So at least, like, I had the warning. Like, you know, I'd have, like, the yellow light of, like, what's up. And, so, you know, I was still, you know, I thought I was, you know, amazing and great and still on top of the world. And, I was having lots of fun. But I started, you know, at this point, when I was working at these bars and I started being like, man, I better watch it. I'm going to end up in that place called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to end up being an alcoholic if I keep going like this. I was like, so, and I can't imagine ever not drinking, so I better, like, slow it down a little bit and, like, get this thing under wraps because, you know, if I can't drink, like, that's going to really not be fun. So I would try to kind of, like, wrap it in and try to tone it down a little bit. I had given up, you know, I would try to, like, not drink when I got off work. That never worked, not one single time. So I was like, well, that's not going to work. So I know I'm going to drink every night. So what can I do to like make this work? So I don't, you know, I don't drink as much. So then I don't have to apologize to as many people. So, you know, I try like silly things. Like, I mean, I think one time I tried to like drink, you know, people would drink a drink and then drink water afterwards. That did not work. I have no idea how people can ever do that. I was telling you all those shots that we would like hand out throughout the night. So if I'm giving 20 people free shots, there's a lot of people that are giving me shots as well. So, you know, I would be like, okay, well, I'll just drink half of a shot. And then when the next round of shots come, I can finish that one. And that would work for maybe like one or two shots a night. That was silly too. I tried my best to like, you know, keep it in wraps, but it didn't really work out that well. At this point too, I was like, the bar where I worked was really hot in the summer. And, I was starting to get that like god awful hangover smell. If you guys have ever like, ugh, it's awful. And it's really embarrassing too, because like somebody actually wrote that on their credit card, like, you smell really bad. And it was really embarrassing. And I knew that I did. Like, you could smell all the alcohol like sweating out of my pores. It's gross. And like, no amount of anything, like, you can't combat that with anything. Like, it's just like you're just stuck with it. My brother came to visit in town with a friend of his, and they were doing some illegal things, and they no longer had a ride, and so they were now living with me. And so now I kind of had this, my brother and this kind of boyfriend living with me, and they did a lot of things that I didn't do. And I was always kind of scared of drugs, so I never wanted to go down that road. Well, I was almost 27 at this point, so I thought it'd be a good idea to give it a try. My life, if you looked at my life from the outside, it looked much worse, like in a very short period of time. But when I was done with it, I was done with it. So we decided to move to try to see if that could, you know, we thought it'd be better there, you know, if we moved to Charleston, South Carolina, it would help a little bit. So we moved there, and it did not go so well because, Richmond was kind of, you know, I mean, I had people knew me. I had some stability here. I moved there. There's a lot younger people there. I couldn't get away with as much. People didn't put up with my crap as much. My boyfriend decided that he wanted to be with someone else, and that's probably because I tried to throw him out of a moving vehicle on a bridge. Oops. He said he had to hang on the side of the truck for dear life. And I really thought he was lying. I was like, I would never do that. I'm sure I probably did do that. But I have no recollection of that whatsoever. You know, thank goodness, like, he held on tight because, so I was doing stuff like this. So it's no wonder that he wouldn't want to be with me. And honestly, I'd wanted to be out of that relationship for a really long time, and I just couldn't end it. So I was kind of relieved. My mom was also very relieved. So when I called her, and told her that that had happened, she was there to, I called her that morning at work. She took off work. She got a U-Haul, and she was in Charleston by that afternoon to come pick me up to get out. Because she was like, this relationship is toxic. You need to get out of it. She kind of blamed him for all of my problems too, just like I did. So I moved back to Richmond, and at this point I was completely unglued. I felt like a balloon that was kind of floating along that had no roots and like nowhere to go. Nothing was working. The alcohol wasn't working anymore. People were getting sick of me. I didn't really have any friends. I was getting fired from jobs. It's probably no, I mean, of course I was. I was, you know, I would be at work and I was working at two bars that were across the street from each other. And I would, while I was working, I would run across the street to the other bar because I was sleeping with my boss who had a girlfriend. And I would be all over him. And he's like, Dawn, you better get off of me. My girlfriend is here. And somebody would have to, like, pick me up and carry me across the street to the other bar where I was working. And when they're doing, I mean, like, three times I did that. And, you know, I mean, people don't really, you tend to get fired when you do things like that, you know? And I had, you know, I mean, like I said, I was in a blackout every night when I was at work, but I always seemed to, you know, be able to do my job still. And I wasn't able to do my job anymore. You know, I wasn't able to, like, count my money at the end of the night. And I'd gotten a, you know, a room with this one girl that I knew. And I'm, like, waking up on the kitchen counter and the stove is still on. The dogs are in the kitchen. And obviously I forgot to take them out because they'd gone to the bathroom everywhere. There's eggs, like, everywhere. And, you know, and I'm, like, waking up on the kitchen counter. Like, why did I pass out on the kitchen counter instead of going to bed? I have no idea. But, and thinking, like, oh, my gosh, thank God she didn't come home and find me like this, you know, so I can, like, clean up my mess and, like, put it back together. But it's, like, getting worse and worse like that. And, you know, I mean, I couldn't put it back together, you know. I mean, it was getting really unpredictable, you know, when I drank. You know, it was to the point, like, I would be totally sober and I would have one drink and I would be, just like our book talks about in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would be insanely drunk. So I didn't have any idea of what I was going to get. And, you know, it was awful, you know. I never really had a relationship with God. I had, and that's just what I call him, for lack of a better, you know, word, or him or her, or, you know, I don't really think about it. I just, you know, it just keeps it simple for me, so I don't have to really think about it. My higher power. I, you know, remember when I was little, I was at my grandparents' house and I got lost riding my bicycle in their neighborhood and I couldn't find my way back home. And I remember praying to God then to, like, help me to get home. And I got home and I remember feeling that comfort and kind of having a spiritual experience with that. And I told my grandmother when I got home that I wanted to get baptized, like, after that. And I did get baptized. And that was, like, the end of it, you know? So that was my, you know, that was the only really relationship I had. My grandparents, on my dad's side, had gone to church and I found it very boring. I didn't really, you know, I mean, there was no connection, no, it didn't mean anything to me at all. Like, I didn't understand what it meant. I didn't understand why people liked going to church. I didn't understand why people, you know, did these weird things, like, in religion or God or, you know, I didn't get it or understand it at all. But I started, coming unglued at the seams and, like, sometimes I remember one time, like, waking up and the four horsemen, you know, were just on me really bad. And I remember I wanted to talk to somebody about God. And, you know, I didn't know where to go or what to do. And I went to this church and was, like, banging on all the windows and I couldn't get in and I was too embarrassed to tell anybody that I needed help. And I knew that I, like, needed help, but I didn't really know what to do. You know, I went to therapy a couple times. And it was kind of embarrassing. I was really scared that they were going to tell me that I was crazy. And, it was, like, my worst fear. I didn't want anybody to ever tell me that I was crazy. So I was kind of scared to, like, let them in on, like, what was really going on with me. And so my friend's mom was, like, a therapist and she would talk to me sometimes for free. And I really liked that. So, you know, I kind of did that too, but it didn't really help. And I would kind of go for walks and try to, you know, get it together and it just, none of it was working. And, I was starting to get fired from all my jobs. And I couldn't even, You know, I mean, I'd been a waitress since I was, like, worked in restaurants since I was 13. And I'm, like, 36 at this point, and I'm, like, getting demoted to, like, food runner because, like, I just can't do it. And, you know, and I knew that, like, my drinking was, I was really scared of it because I would drink and it was totally, I had no idea what was going to happen to me. I was telling, you know, I was cussing out my bosses and you know, just like, I mean, and sometimes it would make it worse, you know. I used to, like, go out drinking and it would be lots of fun. I would feel connected to everybody and feel, you know, like I was part of the party. And it started being that I was, you know, I remember there was this one night in particular, and it was the end of the night, and, you know, all the restaurant people would kind of, like, gather in one restaurant. And they were, everybody was coming over to the restaurant where I worked. And I was pretty drunk at that time. And I remember being like, oh, no. Like, I don't want to drink anymore because the drunker I get, the more of an idiot I'm going to make of myself. And the less, like, it just kind of was, like, tearing me away from other people because I was humiliating myself and I was, like, urinating on myself. And, you know, I just, like, you know, I would think I was, like, saving the world and would write these, like, great notes on BevNabs, thinking, you know, all these great ideas I had. And I'd wake up in the morning and it was, like, not even letters. Like, I don't even know what it was, you know. And that's how I was, like, talking. And, you know, I mean, I wasn't, people were, you know, I was starting to be, like, the outcast. And, you know, and you know when you're the outcast, like, you can feel it, you know. And drinking wasn't, like, helping me with that anymore. It was, like, making it worse. And, so I was scared to drink and I would try to, like, I got this job where I would, oh no, I know what I did. I got a boyfriend. And he was in, he had had a seizure right in front of me, an alcoholic, seizure. And he was in ICU for a couple of weeks. And when he got out of ICU, he was going to AA. And I thought that was really great because that would help me to not drink, because if I drank, I thought that I had the power to kill him if I drank. So that would be a great way to, you know, chill out on my drinking. And, we dated and I was trying not to drink. And I, so what that looked like is I just didn't ever leave my house. You know, he had a son, so we went to Chuck E. Cheese because that was a great restaurant to go to because they don't serve alcohol. I couldn't hang out with any of the people that I knew or any people my own age because they all drank. So I was basically a prisoner in my house. It was pretty much like I was on house arrest. And he was going to AA, and I would get really mad at him if he was gone for longer than 2 minutes after the meeting was done because, like, I was home by myself going crazy. And he ended up relapsing, and I had no idea, like, what to do. So I called some of my friends that I knew were in AA, and was like, you know, what do I do? Like, he's missing, and, you know, I didn't know where he was, and that's where I learned what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. You know, these people from AA, you know, they so helped me. And it wasn't even because of my drinking. I was just a mess because of alcoholism. And it wasn't because I wanted to stop drinking, because I didn't. So I stayed at this one guy's house for a week with him and his wife while my boyfriend was missing. And all these people from AA would come over and talk to me. And he would have all these women call me and come over to the house and talk to me and help me and, like, kind of get me through the week. I have no idea what they said. I have no idea what they look like. I think some of them have come up to me afterwards and been like, oh, do you remember me? And I'm like, no. But they, I remember the feeling that they gave me. They were so warm and welcoming and, you know, these people didn't even know me and they were willing to reach out their hand and help me. And I remember thinking, like, I thought this is what church was supposed to be like, you know, but I never got that feeling at church. I've gone back to church and gotten that feeling, but I never, there was something about what these people were doing that gave me that feeling. And, my friend gave me a big book. We went to Barnes & Noble and he bought me a big book and said, read to the wives. So I did. And, I went to some Al-Anon meetings. I found them very helpful. Some of them were very annoying. I just wanted to slap the people in the meetings, but some of them were very helpful. And I got an Al-Anon sponsor. I knew from him kind of what I was supposed to do for my boyfriend. I knew I had to get a sponsor and do the steps and do, you know, all these things. So I got me an Al-Anon sponsor. And I told her, I knew I kind of had this weird, I knew that I was scared of my drinking. And I told her, I was like, you know, I think I might be an alcoholic. And she's like, why are you whispering? And I said, because I can't say it out loud. And she said, well, I can't tell you if I'm an alcoholic or not. Why don't you go to this meeting? I'll go there with you. I'll meet you there. And listen to the speaker. She's an alcoholic, and you listen to her. And when you listen to her, you know, see how you think like her, feel like her, or have felt like her. And I had been to AA meetings before with my boyfriend, and I thought they were awful because all you guys talked about was how much liars you were. And I was like, yeah, those people are liars, and you're going to hurt me, and they're evil people. But I was really desperate, so I went to this meeting. And it was a completely different story when I did that. I went there, and she got up there, and she spoke a language that I'd never heard before. And she spoke about all those weird, dark things that happened inside of my mind that I could never express. I never had the words to say what they were. I was really embarrassed about them. I thought that's why I was crazy, because of all these like weird, dark things, like thoughts that I had. And, you know, just kind of weird, weird things that I did that didn't like really make sense to me. And she, you know, she had done those same things, you know? And I totally related. And I was like, I have no idea if I have this alcoholism thing or not. But whatever she has, I have that. And I knew it that night. And like I said, I was still this alcoholism thing. Like, I wasn't sure because I thought my drinking was very normal. All these people were like going up and talking to her after, you know, actually the girl that took me to the meeting said, well, why don't you go talk to her? And, the speaker. And, so I did, and I didn't realize that there was like a line of people that say thank you. So, I mean, I was talking to her for like 15 minutes, and, I had no idea that all these people were behind me. And, I was just telling her all this stuff that was going on with me and la la la. And she just patiently, like, I'll never forget it. It brings tears to my eyes. She just let me talk and did not ever even give, like, show me an inkling that there were all these people behind me that were waiting to talk to her. And I'm so thankful that she did that for me. And I remember I turned around and looked at all these people, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so embarrassed. And I was like, why didn't you tell me? And she's like, you're okay. Here's my phone number. Why don't you call me? And I said, can I call you tonight? And she said, yes. So I got home and I called her. And I asked her to be my sponsor. I did pick up a white chip at that meeting. I didn't pick it up at the meeting. I picked it up afterwards because I felt maybe I had a problem, but I wasn't sure if I was an alcoholic or not. I didn't want to be a poser, so I wasn't, like, trying to, you know, I didn't really know how you do that, like, what that meant. It was the first AA meeting. I found that I had gone to NA meetings before that I'd forgotten about, but... So I picked up a white chip like after the meeting. When I got home, I asked her to be my sponsor, and she like got teary eyed, and I thought that was really sweet. She's still my sponsor to this day. I love her very much. And so she started taking me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she would, you know, read it to me, which, thank goodness, because, like, I'm such a mess, I don't think I could have read. And, you know, we would just read and talk and read and talk and read and talk. And she would tell me, like, things. I was like, you know, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. Like, and I remember being really scared, because I didn't know if I belonged here or not. And I was so scared. I'm like, if I don't belong here, then where do I belong? Like, what's going to happen to me? And I was really scared. I was like, you know, what if I'm not an alcoholic? You know, and I was like, what if I'm supposed to go, like, back to Al-Anon? I was like, you know, it was nice there, but, like, it wasn't quite right. You know, it wasn't the same as it was here for me. So she had me go running around to people and ask them how they knew that they were an alcoholic. So I did that. I ran around and I asked all these people, how do you know you're an alcoholic? How do you know you're an alcoholic? How do you know you're an alcoholic? And it's still, like, when everybody talked about how they drank, I was like, well, that's normal. Like, I don't get it. Isn't that how, like, when you drink, like, what happens? And I didn't understand it at all. It wasn't until I went to dinner afterwards with a group of people from Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard one of my home group members, Waves, talking to me about it, about how she drank. And she's like, you know, when I drink a glass of wine, I drink it and I start to feel out of control and I don't like it. So I stop. And I was like, oh my God, if that's what a non-alcoholic is, then I am definitely an alcoholic, because I have never drank like that in my life. I was like, I don't understand that at all. And that's kind of how I knew I was an alcoholic, because I did not drink like a non-alcoholic. Because, you know, to me, this is the only... You know, it says that the alcoholic, it's only, you know, their drinking is very normal to them. So it was very normal to me. My sponsor, I remember there was like a long line of women to give me their phone number that night. It was very overwhelming. I got their phone numbers and I actually like called them. And I wrote little descriptions of all the women beside them. Like who I liked, who I didn't like, happened to remember them, you know. And I would go home and call these ladies, and I had like literally, it gave me a little bit of relief when I talked to them, so I didn't care who they were, you know. And I would talk to them for like 2 hours. They weren't talking, I was talking, and I would see them like the next day to me, and they're like, oh, you know, and I would not know that that's who I talked to. They thought I talked to you for 2 hours last night, and I'm like, oh, whoops, sorry. I mean, I just wanted to get some relief. My head was like so loud and so nonstop, that I just wanted it to stop a little bit. I've never been so uncomfortable in all my life. The first 2 weeks of when I was in AA were absolutely awful. I've never had babies, but I kind of related to childbirth. Like, after you're pregnant and you have a baby, you don't remember afterwards. So that's kind of what my first 2 weeks were like. But I do know that I never want to go back there. So, you know, I will do what I have to do to stay here. Sometimes I don't want to do it, but it is definitely, anything that I don't want to do is definitely way better than those first 2 weeks. So, if that means I have to go to a meeting on a Sunday when I would rather stay in bed or like watch a movie because it's raining, well, then that's what I'll do. And that's why I did, you know, all these things. You know, I did what my sponsor suggested when I was new. And it really wasn't because like I was good. It was because I was like such a mess. It would give me like a little bit of relief. So, so I did it. And, I went to this, I want to thank the ladies who came down with me. I really appreciate that. My sponsor told me she was going out of town to speak, and she asked me if I wanted to come, and I was like, sure. And I got in the car, and I was like, what state are we going to? Like, you know, I mean, I really had no idea what was going on. And she was doing a workshop on the four step. And I remember being like, I'm not there yet. I can't, you know, my sponsor always tells me to stay in the step that I'm in. And I'm only on step one. And that's step four. And I can't jump ahead. So what am I supposed to do when I'm at the meeting? Am I supposed to like close my ears or, you know, I had no idea what's going on. And I was still trying to figure out if I was an alcoholic or not. And, you know, and I remember I got to this meeting and this girl says to me, you know, you don't look like an alcoholic to me. You don't look like you drank a fifth a day. And I remember being like, oh my God. I had a couple of choice words inside my head to say to her, but I didn't say them. And I remember thinking like, you know, I didn't have to drink a fifth a day because like I would drink one drink and I would be like insanely drunk, you know? And you know, that's the thing. It doesn't matter how much you drink. It's not about that. You know, it's not matter if you like drink a fifth a day or a handle a day or a drink a day or, you know, that's not what it's about. So there was also, someone else that was at that, that was doing, part of that workshop. And, I went with a sponsee sister, to this workshop, and I remember being like, man, that's a man right there. And she was like, you're going to marry that guy. And I was like, you are crazy. Well, he is now my husband. I would see him a lot of meetings. So, but we didn't start dating then. He waited until I was, I'm going to tell him, I was 9 months sober. It wasn't a year. But I had done my steps, and he said I had a spiritual awakening. My sponsor said I wasn't quite ready yet to date, that I should wait a little bit, but it already started, and so there we have it. And she was right, I wasn't quite ready. And, you know, we dated for a long time, for like 8 years, and we broke up, and I realized then that I wasn't quite ready. Because in that time that we'd broken up, I'd actually blossomed into the flower and the woman that I was supposed to be. And I would have never have had that opportunity in being in a relationship. So it was an absolutely beautiful experience because I actually got to fall in love with myself. And that's phenomenal. And I also fall in love with life. I guess maybe they kind of go hand in hand, falling in love with life and falling in love with yourself. Life was always kind of torturous to me. I remember my first, when I was first going to those meetings, I would, sometimes I'd go to 2 meetings a day if I was just feeling super crazy. And I didn't have a car, so I was walking to a meeting, and it was about a half an hour walk. And I'm walking there, and I was having like a really depressive day, and like, you know, feeling all sorry for myself. And I was like, you know, I just want to end it. I'm going to jump off a bridge. And I went to this meeting, and of course, like, I shared in this meeting that I wanted to kill myself, and I was all dramatic, and the funny thing about it is, like, the very next day, I'm walking to the very same meeting, and I'm thinking to myself, those people at that meeting are not doing it right. They need to listen to me, because this meeting is awful, and I know some things now, and I'm going to tell them when I share this meeting today how they're supposed to do it. And my sponsor shared with me, and she's like, Dawn, weren't you, like, sharing at the meeting yesterday that you wanted to kill yourself, and the next day you think you know everything? And I was like, oh, yeah. And I mean, it just kind of goes to show how my perception can be so off, you know? I don't really know all the time, like, what's going on in my head. Luckily, you know, we do get some sense of relief from that by doing the 12 steps and working with a sponsor and all that. Like, my, you know, I mean, that's the best thing. Like, your perception gets a little better, and you can kind of see what's really going on. And you get more of a solution to, like, fix those things. And more relationships to be like, oh, Lynn, what's going on? This is what I think's going on. Is this really what's happening? So, you know, you get relationships. So I slowly, like, started getting better. You know, I had all these, like, great gifts in sobriety. They happened pretty fast. I had opportunity to, you know, my father was very, whenever I would talk about my recovery, it would always make him really sad.
because he had been on methadone and was dying, and he was dying this, like, very slow death. And he regretted a lot of choices that he made, and always felt really guilty about it. So whenever I would talk about my recovery, like, he would always cry and get really sad and feel really bad. So I wanted to make amends to him before he died, and I prayed and prayed and prayed about it. Well, actually, at first I hated him for a long time, and I prayed and prayed and prayed till I was willing to make those amends, and then I was finally willing to make those amends. And I wasn't sure if I was supposed to. You know, it says we're not supposed to cause harm. And I was like, you know, I never hear anybody share that they, like, don't make an amends because it's going to cause harm, especially when they're going to die, you know? And I knew that I wasn't supposed to, that it would just cause them more harm, and I didn't want to do that to him. Because I finally realized that he was just like me, you know? And I had this great opportunity to get better. And I got to watch him slowly die over 10 years. You know, and he looked like he was dying for 10 years. And, you know, I didn't have to live like that. So who was it for me to, like, make him feel bad for that? You know, I had this hope, this amazing gift, and he doesn't. And that's, like, the last thing I wanted to do. I just wanted to show him compassion and love. So that's what I did. And when he died, I went to his grave and made my amends. And, you know, that was what I was supposed to do, and it was amazing. You know, a lot of my other amends, I didn't want to make. I had a lot of financial ones. I made those, you know, I started making those, but, like, ones to people. You know, it took me a while to realize that it was me that was the problem, you know. I really thought that, you know, I was an alcoholic and I didn't know why I did these things or what I did. And I didn't really think I had to take responsibility for them. I mean, I was willing to make the amends. Like, I knew I was supposed to, but it was more like a check mark. Like, I had no feeling behind it. And it took a while for me to feel like that. You know, I've had opportunity and love going to meetings whenever I travel. You know, it's, I like to, you know, find what their flavor of AA is like. You know, we were just looking online to go to the International, which, if you've never gone, is absolutely phenomenal. You know, how many people? Is it like 50,000 people or something? Alcoholics Anonymous in one room praying. Like, that is amazing. You know, and now I have this relationship with my higher power. That's phenomenal. You know, I finally feel like I belong. You know, that I have my place here on this earth. And, you know, life is beautiful, even on its bad days, its ugly days, its hard days. You know, I have a solution here, things that I can do. You know, and I get an opportunity to watch these beautiful women get better, you know. And that's such a gift. You know, it's not always like, I don't know, it's always way better than it was when I was drinking and waking up, you know. My favorite day in sobriety, I was just telling someone the other day, was the day after my first birthday sober. I woke up and I was not hungover, which is really nice. I was not embarrassed. I woke up by myself with my clothes on. And I didn't have to walk out of my house humiliated. I didn't have to dodge anybody. I could look people in the eye. I could walk down the street with my head held high, being proud of myself and my life. And that was amazing. You know, I had all these people that had called me to wish me happy birthday. I didn't realize at that point that everybody on Facebook wished you happy birthday. So I just kind of on Facebook. So I thought all these people really liked me. I mean, you know, I'm sure they did, but I was super excited because I had, like, all these people that wished me happy birthday on Facebook. So that was really nice, too. You know, I mean, and these are just, like, the great things that we get an opportunity to do here, you know? I've been able to have a career, a job, a car. You know, I've gotten to be with my mom in the ICU when she has... she was taking so many Oxycontin that she would kind of pass out holding her ankles, kind of nod out. And she was in ICU for like or 6 days, I think. She still has brain injury from it. I was able to go to rehab with my mother and be there for her with that. She, you know, I mean, those are just like great gifts, you know. I get to, well, it's time for me to stop, so I guess I'll stop. Thank you so much.